from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Jennifer Rodriguez spent her teens in foster group homes, homeless shelters, and even juvenile hall. Today, she has a law degree from UC Davis and runs a nonprofit organization with a mission to improve foster care. Rodriguez joins us in studio to share her story as we launch a series looking at the foster care system. Join us next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. In the 1980s, Jennifer Rodriguez's case file included incidents of violence, homelessness, group homes, and psychotropic drugs. Rodriguez was a teen in the Bay Area foster care system with a record of shoplifting and prostitution. Today, she runs the Youth Law Center, a national organization dedicated to protecting the rights of youth in foster care and the juvenile justice system through litigation and policy change. Over the next few weeks, Forum will be exploring California's foster care system. Jennifer Rodriguez, welcome to Forum. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So you are now the executive director of the Youth Law Center. How long have you been with them?
I've now been with the Youth Law Center as an attorney for the past 8 years, and I've been the executive director just going on 4 years.
And these days, the Youth Law Center is focused, I mentioned that it's focused on, you know, policy advocacy and helping foster youth and folks in the juvenile justice system, but you're focused a lot on parenting these days.
That's correct. You know, our premise and sort of what I think informs all of the work that we do at the Youth Law Center is that fundamentally the thing that children need most in order to heal and in order to thrive is that relationship with an adult who loves them, the structure of a family and the support of parenting. I think over the past decade or so, as a community, we've heard more and more about how important parents are, that parents are their children's first teacher, they form the basis of all relationships for the rest of their life. And for children who are in the foster care system, it's no different.
I read a statistic that some 40% of foster parents withdraw in the first year. Why?
So I think a common misconception is that foster parents withdraw because the children are challenging. But in fact, from talking to foster parents and in work on another project we do, the Quality Parenting Initiative, what we hear is that foster parents actually find the job of parenting kids unbelievably fulfilling and important, but that the system becomes very, very hard to work with for them, that it's harder to do a good job as a foster parent than it is to do a bad job.
So what are some examples of this bureaucratic dysfunction, if you will?
Well, the examples, I could give you an example sort of at every stage for foster parents. It's everything from waiting for a really long time to get a license to be a foster parent, to not getting any information at all on the child when they're placed in your home, to having to fight to ensure that your child has the medical care necessary because you don't have a health insurance card, or you were never told whether that child is on prescription medication or if they have allergies, to larger issues like barriers that are in place that, you know, workers telling foster parents that they can't leave the county without getting social worker approval or court process approval when they simply want to go from, say, San Jose to San Francisco to go see the lights in Union Square.
Were you placed with foster families? I know that you had a lot of experience in group homes.
No, I never had the opportunity to live in a family. And if I would sort of characterize what has probably impacted my both my life in foster care and my experience in foster care, but even maybe more profoundly, my experience as an adult and as a parent now myself. I would say that that experience of never being parented and not growing up in a family probably had the biggest impact.
Jennifer Rodriguez is executive director of the Youth Law Center based in San Francisco, which advocates for youth in foster care and in the juvenile justice system, and is a product of the foster care system herself. Can I ask you, when did you enter the foster care system and how?
I entered as a teenager into care, and my family had always been involved with sort of child protective systems. The child protective system. My mom was paranoid schizophrenic and was very had a lot of mental health challenges growing up. And my father was incarcerated. And so before coming into foster care and then subsequently after, I spent time on the street and, you know, finally entered in to stay in my teens and stayed until I turned 18. And at that time, we didn't have foster care to 21. We had foster care to 18. So on my 18th birthday, I left my last placement.
And why were you never placed with families?
I think the answer to that is a complicated answer. So I'll tell you what was told to me while I was in care, and then I'll give you sort of a broader answer. So I think that the reason I was never placed with families was because in the Bay Area, there's really a shortage of families who are willing and able to take teenagers. What I was told while I was in care was basically my behavioral issues and, you know, some of the challenges I were dealing with made me inappropriate to live in a family, that instead I needed to be in institutional care, which I now find ironic because basically when I think about the years that I spent in foster care and my childhood, instead of being parented and sort of given that love and nurturance that might have actually helped me learn new behaviors and deal with some of the loneliness and the anger and the sadness that I felt, my whole childhood was basically supervised by, you know, really some of them really nice college age staff who, you know, still lived at home with their own parents and would, you know, kind of make us follow a level system and do bed checks every 15 minutes with a flashlight in my group homes, but couldn't actually offer any of the nurturance that I might have needed to become healthy.
And when you say that there were certain aspects of your behavior, you have been open about the fact that you, you know, had been involved in shoplifting and in prostitution. And I understand that a significant number of teens in foster care are involved in those things. And I was wondering if that shapes how you're looked at when you enter the system.
Oh, absolutely. You know, one of the things that the system really struggles with is looking at young people as, and this sounds really crass, but as people. I think that, you know, in general, social workers and homes and the court get really used to thinking about youth as a collection of behaviors, that defines them. And the behaviors that you mentioned, you know, they obviously didn't define who Jennifer was. They were things that I was doing at that particular moment in time. But also I will say, you know, I was a teenager and I was a scrappy teenager. I knew what to do to survive and to take care of myself. And so I had those behaviors. I ran away. I got into fights. You know, I ended up having to spend time in psychiatric hospitals because I thought about killing myself. And there was a whole range of behaviors that I had that were really the only coping and survival mechanism that I knew in the system.
You were quoted as saying the qualities that may cause ripples in a system and make a young person not quite fit into the model end up being qualities that are really assets. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think the perfect example would be that one of the words that was most frequently used to describe me while I was in foster care was that I was manipulative. And that I was an instigator. So oftentimes in my group homes, I would end up getting involved in other other residents that lived in the home and their issues and create a lot of problems for the staff because, you know, somebody else was treated unfairly. Their level was dropped and I didn't think their level should have been dropped, or somebody was restrained. I still remember one of the biggest altercations I had was there were staff that restrained a little boy who I felt like they were going to break. And so I tried to drag the staff off of this child and ended up getting put into a quiet room and restrained for days. And I'm sure that stayed in my record forever. But the funny thing about that is now I'm a lawyer, obviously, and the qualities of being manipulative, sort of knowing how to maneuver through to get the result that you want, and instigating, being willing to speak out if you see an injustice, and, you know, to ensure that everyone around doesn't just ignore that injustice, that those are qualities that are actually really valued in the legal profession, and particularly as an advocate.
Jennifer Rodriguez grew up in the foster care system through group homes and stayed in until she was 18 years old. She is now executive director of the Youth Law Center in San Francisco, which advocates for youth in foster care and in the juvenile justice system. And you have personal experience with the juvenile justice system as well. How did you end up in juvenile hall?
No, because of the behaviors that I mentioned to you. So I was picked up several times and placed into juvenile hall. And, you know, one of the things about being a teen that has behaviors is that it becomes increasingly more challenging for social workers to find a placement that would take you. And so I ended up spending, you know, stretches of time in juvenile hall here in San Francisco and in San Mateo as social workers tried to find another group home that would be willing to take me. But, you know, the only description that placements get typically are almost a rap sheet, a rundown of all of the things that you've done that are negative in the past. So I didn't sound very desirable.
Can I ask you what that experience was like in the juvenile justice system? As somebody who experienced abuse, as somebody who both physical and sexual, and also, you know, I guess I'm curious if you felt like the system was equipped to handle some of your needs, or whether or not they almost exacerbated them.
Yeah, absolutely not. I still remember the first time I was picked up and taken to juvenile hall. And thankfully, this is a practice that's changed. But I was asked to strip off my clothes in front of staff members, and they put lye shampoo in my hair and literally hosed me down. And then did contraband checks that were really invasive, sort of, and one of the staff was a male staff. And that absolutely exacerbated sort of every trauma that I'd ever had around feeling out of control. And, you know, I had no trust that adults would take care of me. So, I didn't feel like that environment in juvenile hall was one that where I could actually heal and sort of habilitate at all. It was one where I think my behaviors and my cynicism about whether or not anybody would ever be able to meet my needs got worse.
And does that still go on now?
So the particular practice that I mentioned doesn't happen at that juvenile hall. I made sure of that.
How did you make sure of it?
Actually visited that juvenile hall and asked specifically about sort of intake procedures and showering, and they've changed all of that. However, there are still equally traumatic practices that happen in juvenile halls across California. Use of pepper spray on youth who are feeling depressed or suicidal. Restraints and takedowns that happen that reinforce to youth that they have no control over not only their physical environment, but their own bodies. So there are many, many ways I think that our juvenile justice system could improve and ensure that that there are spaces if youth have to be there, and that's a big if, but if they do have to be there, that there are spaces where they can actually heal.
We're talking with Jennifer Rodriguez, who spent her teens in foster group homes, homeless shelters, juvenile hall. Today, she has a law degree from UC Davis and runs the Youth Law Center based in San Francisco, a national organization that advocates on behalf of foster youth and kids in the juvenile justice system. I'd like to actually put out the call to our listeners. If they have experiences with the foster care system, give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. Or if you are a foster parent, an employee of the system, or if you just have thoughts on the way we run our foster system here in California, give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on Facebook or on our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. I'm wanting to ask you about the fact that you were also described as being on psychotropics. So these were medications that were prescribed to you?
That's right. They were prescribed to me by a psychiatrist. And I think I was put on my first sort of regimen of psych meds when I entered my first group home placement. And when I entered that placement, I had just come from the street. And so I had a sleeping schedule of being up all night and sort of napping during the daytime because that's what was safe. And obviously in a facility that has a number of youth to care for and, you know, one staff who stays up graveyard shift, that doesn't work out well. So I was initially put on meds so that I would go to sleep at nighttime. But then, of course, I couldn't perk up from those meds in the morning time. So then I was put on another round of antidepressant medications that would make me wake up. So I went sort of in that, you know, that first 6 months while I was in foster care, I was a disaster. I was sleeping in school every day. And then probably around 10 or 11, I would perk up and be bouncing off the walls and literally couldn't hold a pencil because my hands were shaking, which just looked as if I needed more psychotropic medication. So it's sort of a vicious cycle.
Yeah, the Mercury News did an investigation, and it found that California's foster children are being prescribed these types of medications at alarming rates. And similar to what you described, it suggested that they were being used almost as convenience to enable the group home to function, as opposed to always being used because they were deemed medically necessary for whatever issues you might be experiencing. Do you agree with that assessment?
I absolutely agree with that. I mean, the thing that we all have to understand is that children who are removed from their home and placed in foster care are in crisis. They are grieving the loss of everything that they knew previously, even if the removal is sort of the best thing for them in their life. They're grieving the loss of the family life that they had previously, of their friends and the home and the bed that they used to sleep in and their stuffed animals, you know, that were in their bed. And so they are going to exhibit how children do. Children don't have the ability that adults do to say, you know, I'm feeling really angry or I'm feeling really sad. And, you know, here's what I'm going to do to take care of myself. Children express in different ways. You know, they express through their behavior. And anybody who's a parent or loves kids knows that a lot of times those behaviors are not pretty behaviors. But the response cannot be to, you know, sort of subdue and medicate with psychotropic medications that are really dangerous. We don't know what the effect is on developing little brains and little bodies. The effect has to actually give youth the time and the kind of appropriate supports that we would give our own kids to grieve and to let out anger.
Do you think the medications have had a long-term effect on you?
I absolutely do. I mean, it's impossible to know, you know, sort of what the effects are and how those have played out. But I mean, one of the examples is that, you know, in that first year in foster care, I gained 100 pounds. And so there's sort of no way that your body can withstand that kind of chemical change and those sort of pressures without it having some kind of a long-term effect.
I find it interesting that you describe the intense traumas that the kids are experiencing. But I also read one of the things that seemed to really strike you about the experience of foster kids is that they're kids that there's not someone in their lives who knows what their favorite food is or exactly what they want for Christmas. And I found that interesting because there are such intense and horrific experiences that the kids face, that that was something that you wanted to point out. And I wanted to know why that tears at you.
I think it tears at me because I'm a mother. I'm a mother, and my children's sort of identity and understanding of themselves and how special they are is a direct reflection of when I look at them and what I see. So I think my children are, you know, the sweetest, smartest, like most unique and special beings in the world. And because I believe that for them, they believe that too. And they have grown up sort of never doubting that they'll get exactly what they want for their birthday and for Christmas because I know them. Growing up feeling like nobody sees anything that's a light in you as a child, that all they see are sort of the cracks in your being, and that people don't know anything about you, let alone remember when your birthday is or how old you are, so what kind of gift you might want. It's Christmas. It actually makes you feel like you're a non-person. I know when in most of the group homes I was in, we were called residents, and we weren't even referred to by our names. And that was how I felt. I felt as if I was just basically a commodity, a person to fill a bed, as opposed to a kid that was special and important.
You're getting at really this sense of self-worth. Mm-hmm. It sounds like to me. And you have two kids now. Your son is 11 and your daughter is 8.
Yes.
And how has that transition to parenting been as someone who describes herself as never really having been parented?
It's been really interesting. I mean, in some ways, I feel like I have learned more about the reforms that need to happen in foster care from my experience parenting my children than I even have from my own life experience growing up in care, because I see what my children need. And I think even more importantly, I see what my children deserve and how unwilling I am to settle for anything less than what they deserve. And that's the feeling that I believe everyone in the foster care system should be approaching reform with. Doesn't matter if it's hard. It doesn't matter if it seems impossible. If it's what our kids need, then we should do it. But in terms of the actual sort of my own experience as a parent, I would say it's been challenging. I never intended to actually have my own children. Because I had so much fear about how on earth I would be able to parent kids when I was not parented myself, when my early childhood was filled with so much confusion and abuse because of, you know, the challenges that my family struggled with, and that my later childhood was basically filled with no nurturance at all and no parenting at all. I was terrified that I would basically have a baby and screw the baby up. So I was lucky enough to, and I emphasize luck because it wasn't anything that was systemically provided, to have a couple of people who have really stepped in and who have showed me the ropes. I was just telling somebody that when I brought my baby home from the hospital, my now 11-year-old, that the, Daryl Steinberg, who at the time was in the assembly, his chief of staff, Kathy Dressler, she came home with me from the hospital and showed me how to bathe my baby and put a diaper on my baby for the first time because I was terrified of him. So little small things like that, but also bigger issues.
And we'll continue our conversation with Jennifer Rodriguez. She grew up through the foster care system here in the Bay Area and now runs an organization working to improve the foster care system and the juvenile justice system. After the break, more with Jennifer Rodriguez and your calls. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. My guest is Jennifer Rodriguez, Executive Director of the Youth Law Center, which advocates for youth in foster care and the juvenile justice system. And Jennifer Rodriguez was a teenager in the foster care system and aged out at 18. We'd like to welcome your calls and your experiences with the foster care system. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on Facebook or on our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Brian in Oakland. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Thank you for this show. This is a really terrific topic.
Thank you.
I have a question for Jennifer. We're relatively new foster parents. We've been in the system for, we've had our foster son for just over 6 months. He's 12. He's a terrific kid, just a delight. But our county worker basically says they want to have him assessed for medication needs. This is something we didn't request. I don't think it's something that we feel is necessary. And, it's just they're going to have to really convince us to do this. And I'm just curious, A, why are they doing this without a request? And B, what can we do in terms to make sure the right thing gets done?
Brian, thank you so much for your call, and thank you for being a foster parent and for loving this child who's in your home. And I'm so glad for your question, because what you're saying is exactly what we want to see foster parents doing. I mean, nobody knows the child the way you do. When that little guy lives in your house 24/7, you see his behaviors, you see what his needs are. And so I think it's really appropriate, actually, as a foster parent, that you ask many questions, just like any parent would. And make sure that you're a part of the decision-making process and ask the questions that you're asking right now to the county social worker, ask to speak to the psychiatrist about why they feel the medication is necessary, about what other measures have been taken or could be taken as an alternative to psychotropic medications. I mean, there's so many things that we know now about alternative ways to deal with behaviors, whether it's diet changes or getting a child involved in, you know, boxing or running or giving them a journal. So, I mean, I think that I would really encourage you to continue being an advocate and to know that it's entirely appropriate. Don't let anybody tell you that you should not be an advocate for the child that's in your care.
What kind of power do parents have to stop something like this, say, if they disagree with it?
So the answer to that question is a complicated one. It depends. When you say parents, there are foster parents, there are legal guardians, there are adoptive parents, and sort of what your rights and ability to intervene are depend on where you are at and on that parenting spectrum.
Well, Brian, thanks for the question. Let's go to Danny. Hi, Danny in Oakland.
Hey there, Jennifer. Thank you so, so much for the work that you're doing. I appreciate it so much. As a CASA, I'm a court-appointed special advocate, which is a volunteer position where we advocate for foster youth. And I've had a foster youth for 2.5 years now. He's an awesome, awesome kid, dealing with all kinds of issues around gender and sexual orientation stuff, which is one whole thing to deal with. But the reason I'm calling is because he's been placed in like 4 different group homes. The last one that he was placed in was here in Oakland, where he was there for a good portion of the time I've been working with him. And it was a hellhole. And I had no idea how bad a foster home could be, where he was dealing with violence, staff that were homophobic. I mean, great staff, too, but just awful. And every time something would happen with him, I would say, just suck it up. You got to deal with it. This is the best we can do right now, having no idea that there were other options. So finally, he was in a juvenile center for some outrageous behavior, placed in a group home now in Ceres, California, about 1.5 hours from here, which is a challenge for me right now, but whatever. And it's an amazing group home, and his behavior has changed 100%, and he doesn't need to be on some of the meds that he was on before. And for me, it's just such an indication of environment, and then it also, I think, highlights how limited a CASA can be. And I just think it highlights another glitch in the whole system.
Danny, thanks for the call.
Yeah, thank you, Danny. I love CASAs, too. I think it's so important to have somebody who is outside of the system looking really at the child and what their needs are. And so really appreciate the work that you're doing. And I'll just say, I think that some of the most insightful conversations that I've had with folks about what needs to change and the problems in the way we currently do things are with CASAs, who are folks who are really lay people who are looking at it in the context of what would I want from my own child or a child that I really cared about. And then it all becomes ridiculous. That's when some of the decisions that are getting made, like why would you have a child who's struggling with gender identity or sexuality placed in a group home where they're basically going to be abused by staff who are homophobic and by other youth who don't support their identity. So I really appreciate the work you're doing, and I entirely agree with you. I mean, we know this about kids. Environment is everything. An environment can literally make or break a child, no matter how resilient they are.
Are there efforts to improve supports for kids who are dealing with gender issues?
I think over the past, 5 to 7 years, there's been an incredible amount of awareness that this population of youth even exists. I mean, when I was in care, there were such inappropriate things that happened as a matter of practice, like, youth who were female but identified as male and were living, as a male day in and day out, placed in a girls' group home, which, that alone is just entirely disrespectful and invalidating. And that there was no other option. At least now there are discussions that happen, and there is required training for both social workers and for foster parents and for group home staff. So while I think that there's a lot of work still to be done, we've at least acknowledged that this is a population of youth that really needs to have some special care and attention.
Let's go to Rick in Santa Rosa. Hi, Rick.
Hey, hi, Jennifer. Thank you for your story. It's very compelling, and I have to tell you it's all true. I'm a foster dad and adopted father and have been working for many years as a therapist at a group home. A couple of questions. First of all, in relation to the comment you just made about the last caller just made about sexual identity issues. There is a very good treatment facility here in Sebastopol. It's not the agency I work for, but it's a TLC, and they do a terrific job of helping guys and young women and seeking people find their identity. Just wanted to put that out there for TLC. But my question to you really is about we have a lot of young men here at the group home I work at who have bounced through so many foster homes. They've landed here. We've managed, I think, to create a fairly comfortable therapeutic healing community for them. And I guess I'm just wondering if you've come across group homes that you think do a good job, and if so, what are some of the qualities that you think, if a young person needs to be in a group home, what some of those qualities are that would allow a group home to do good work, in your opinion?
Thanks for your question. So I find your question actually difficult to answer because I don't think that we currently use group homes in the right way. I will answer your question two ways. Even some of the best group homes that I've seen are not good places for a child to grow up, period. However, some of those group homes would be entirely appropriate as a therapeutic intervention for a child to get them treatment, to get them stabilized, and then to be able to send them back to their community and to a family. So I think it all depends. It depends how you're using group homes. Now, the ones that I think are good facilities, they actually sort of have a therapeutic model in them. They're providing therapeutic services by highly trained staff who really see the therapeutic milieu as 24/7. It's in every interaction that they have with kids. There are ones where children are not isolated. They're not forced to sort of stay on the facility to go to school and to live, where they have lots of social contacts and they really feel integrated into the community outside. And where, again, like I said earlier, where the youth are not treated as sort of, this is a cutter, or this is a commercially sexually exploited youth, but this is Jose, or this is Ariana. This is a child. They happen to have these behaviors at this moment, and we'll work with them to sort of find more healthy behaviors, but that ultimately we see them as the person they are, and more importantly, as the amazing human being that they're going to be in the future.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Mary writes, many group home children are not involved in the behaviors your guest was. Most group home children come from violent and dysfunctional families and feel very safe when they're placed in a high-quality group home. Please do not paint all group homes with this one person's experience. We have many significantly disturbed children who do not qualify for foster care because of numerous failed foster placements and need to be in high-quality group homes. Mark writes, I appreciate your guest's critique of the foster care system and the parade of horribles she endured, but I've not heard her say anything about anyone who had helped her, gone to bat for her, or did anything above and beyond the minimum to get help to her to where she is today. No discussion of foster care is complete without an acknowledgement of the real people who, as this interview illustrates, get very little credit for their work and commitment. And I appreciate Mark's question, because actually that is where I wanted to go with you in terms of what interventions did you find actually really helped you? Where did you... I know you've described it sometimes as luck, but then there have been also some other examples of things that really helped change your life.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that question too, because I actually think we learn more from looking at what works than we do from looking at what doesn't work. And I will say that I feel like I got the foundation for my entire life when I exited foster care and found Job Corps. So Job Corps is a program that's for at-risk youth, and they provide you a place to live and help you get your GED and into vocational training. And so I left my last group home to homelessness, but then found out about Job Corps. And I'll just mention that the way that I found out about Job Corps is because my coping mechanism while I was in foster care was to read. And so I hung out in the library all the time and saw a resource book in there, saw a little description of Job Corps, and signed up. And something that really literally changed my life was that every single student who comes into Job Corps gets assessed for their readiness for the GED test. And so on the assessment test, they take the folks who score the highest on different subject areas and they stick them into something called the Academic Olympics. And I happened, because I was a reader, to score the highest in sort of the vocabulary and spelling. And so I was put into the Academic Olympics and for the first time was related to as if I was smart. And I was in special education as a kid. And that really helped me to change my identity and sort of my expectations about whether I would be able to go to school or not. So that was an incredibly important experience. And Job Corps gave me all of those basic things. It gave me job training. It gave me the GED, a place to live so that I could really launch my life.
And we have heard from callers examples of the foster care system that have really been beneficial and helpful to kids. And I know you talked a little bit about what makes a really effective group home. Right now, there is a new law that will take effect that will try to give families who provide foster care more support. Mm-hmm. That's AB 403. And that they're looking at moving away from the use of long-term group homes. What's your opinion on AB 403?
I think AB 403 is really a landmark bill, both in California and across the country. It's the first time, in my opinion, that our state policy has aligned with what child development research tells us, which is that the most important intervention that we can provide to any child is parenting. And so there, in my mind, there it's incredibly important, and there will be have to be a lot of reforms that happen in order to realize this goal. But I think the group home restrictions and sort of us setting the bar and saying what we believe every single child in foster care deserves is they deserve to be in a family, and we will figure out how to ensure that they land there is really, really important.
And I should mention that we'll be talking about AB 403 more in depth next week as part of our series looking at foster care. I want to go to a couple more calls. Maria in Travis.
Yes, I am a product of the whole system that the guest has described. I went into care. I was taken from my home because I ran away because I was being abused by my stepmother. I was put in a group home. I'm a person of color. Lived in a predominantly white environment, was molested, beaten, and everything else. But fortunately, was able to find some intervention with a teacher. But I really want to say that, you know, long term, this has impacted my relationships. It has impacted my skills as a parent. I think that there should be some kind of long term care or counseling, because I think that I'm suffering from post traumatic stress. And you know what happens? And as the guest said, at the age of 18, one is kind of tiptoed into the system, out of the system, and one has no place to go. But fortunately, I was able to go to college. But it still impacted my relationships. It impacted even my job performance, because I would have these flashbacks whenever I would have someone who was completely authoritarian in these situations. It impacted my parenting skills and so forth. But there needs to be some kind of system in place where there is counseling or some kind of support provided afterwards, some kind of counseling, even into adulthood.
Maria, thanks for sharing your story and for your question. What kind of supports are available when kids age out of the system? I know the age has been increased to 21, but other than that.
Right. So, yeah. And Maria, and I think your point is so important, that the decisions that we make today for a child, I feel like we often don't think about how those decisions end up having ripple effects that last not only through their own life, but in the lives of their children and their children's children. So there are supports that are in place. There are organizations that one example of an organization, one based here in the Bay Area, is A Home Within, that provides free therapy for anybody who's been in foster care, sort of with one therapist. It's pro bono therapy for the rest of that person's life, if they'd like. There are some amazing college support programs, Guardian Scholar programs, that aim to give youth sort of the feeling that they belong on a college campus and all of the supports necessary to make their college experience successful. And actually, those programs end up, contrary to the statistics that people hear about, you know, that it's only sort of 5% of youth that end up ever graduating from college, those college support programs have higher graduation rates than the general public. So I think that there is an increasing sort of understanding that foster care and its effects don't just magically disappear at 21, and that we need to build in supports. We now have Medi-Cal available to former foster youth until age 26. So we're slowly moving in the direction of making sure that youth have their needs met as they move into adulthood, but nothing like what Maria is suggesting.
What happened to you when you aged out at 18?
So as I mentioned, I went to Job Corps, and after Job Corps.
But before Job Corps, immediately after?
Immediately after, I was homeless. So I had my stuff in a trash bag, and it's so stereotypical, but it's true, the big old black trash bag, and ended up being homeless in San Jose and having literally no place to sleep. So I experienced that actually as a personal failure. You know, the whole time I was in all of my placements, staff people would kind of console me and say, don't worry, like, you'll be 18 and then your life will be on your own terms. And then here I was 18 and my life was on my own terms and I was homeless. So I felt like it's probably never going to get better.
Elizabeth writes, first, Jennifer, you're an amazing inspiration on so many levels. Thank you for all your hard work and others, for others and yourself. What would you say to those who are interested in fostering kids but are concerned about their behavior as a result of trauma they've experienced up to that point and might be very difficult to manage? I've heard many people say they would like to foster, but that holds them back. How would you suggest overcome this issue on both sides, both ends?
So I would suggest that sort of as a first step that you talk to some foster parents who have been caring for kids. And, you know, one of the things is that I actually think there is that the behaviors that get described make them sound as if they're more scary and intimidating than they actually are. If you've been able to deal with a toddler who has a tantrum, then I guarantee you that you can deal with some of these behaviors. You know, just like kids do when they get a substitute teacher or, you know, kids test the water to see if you'll be there and you'll care about them. But, you know, there's nothing, in my opinion, and this sounds so cheesy, but there's nothing that love and nurturing and knowing that somebody actually cares about you can't heal. And so I really encourage you to talk to some people who have actually been doing the work, to talk to some young people or now adults who have been in care, who have had some of those behaviors, who will tell you, here's what I needed to make me stop. I know in my case, what I needed was when I exited my group home, like, for example, like I have never gotten in a fight again as an adult. I've never cut on myself again as an adult. It's just I did what everybody else did there. I was a teenager. So in the places that I lived, I adapted. As soon as you put me into an environment, and my first job out of Job Corps was working at a very fancy hotel, the Fairmont, and none of that would be tolerated, including no cuss words. And so I quickly adapted. That's one thing that children who are in foster care are really good at doing.
I was struck earlier when you talked about raising your own children and how different their experiences will be and have been from yours. And it's wonderful to know that they won't have to experience what you had to experience. But at the same time, when you become a parent, you're forced to confront just how awful you were treated. A lot of times, people in abusive situations, in order to survive or protect themselves, they have to sort of believe that what's happening to them isn't as horrific as it really is. But then when they become parents, they confront that. And I'm wondering if you went through that experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think right after both of my children were born, I had a period of real grief where I just couldn't understand why nobody wanted me. Because when I looked at these precious babies and I thought, like, I would do anything, like, I'd literally die for them right now, it's hard to you realize this is the depth of emotion that us adults are supposed to have for kids, and nobody had this for me, which is really hard. And then I also think, you know, as my children get older, I'm often in disbelief. I, you know, look at my son, particularly now who's 11, and I can't imagine that he's the same 11 that I was when I was out doing some of the things that I was doing to be able to survive. I mean, my son at 11, he's a snuggler and, you know, he just the sweetest kid in the world. You know, he's still scared of getting on the bus and mean men. And so I think to myself, like, was I really 11? Like, you know, so it's very disconcerting. And it makes me feel even more so that there's so much urgency to make sure it's a whole group of children who have never had a chance to have a childhood, who live right here in the Bay Area. They live right here in California. And we have to do everything possible to make sure those children have that experience.
We do hear a lot about how there's a shortage of foster homes. What's the situation like now? Has it improved?
So I think that's a really hard question. And to me, the shortage of foster homes is not a sort of straightforward term. So I think that there's an incredible amount of people who would be willing and interested in being foster parents if they just knew about the opportunity. And I also think there are many people who try to be foster parents who end up quitting because the system is just simply too hard to work with. So part of what we see, I mentioned earlier that one of the projects that the Youth Law Center works on is the Quality Parenting Initiative. And that's an initiative that really works with child welfare jurisdictions, public agencies. We're in 50 jurisdictions across the country to reorient their practice and policy around high-quality parenting and what they need to do to support those parents, and to really look at foster parents as sort of the most important intervention and a valued member of the team. That what we hear is that so many foster parents are unwilling or exit simply because they don't feel like they have that position on the team, just like the caller earlier who said, you know, I'm the person who knows my 12-year-old son. However, nobody will tell me why is he on medications and we don't want this for him. That's the type of thing that will discourage families from wanting to foster. And those are the things we have to address.
A listener writes, I'm a former foster care caseworker. The thing that I learned best from our amazing and incredible foster parents was that there is a very fine divide between those people who have a support system in their lives and those that do not. To hear a foster parent say to a birth parent, I could have totally been in the same place you are. I could have been part of the system, too, if I didn't have people in my life who supported me in really tough times. This was an amazing display of humility, grace, and understanding of what is often misunderstood. Let's go to Brenda in Sacramento. Hi, Brenda.
Hi, it's Brenna.
Oh,
thank
Brenna.
You very much for this topic. And I just wanted to tell you that I did also experience foster care when I was a child. My mom was in AA recovery for a stint in the Los Angeles area. And most of the abuses that occurred were during being in homes with families and other kids, physical and the other. But when I went to college and I was to present a paper that was 2 weeks late due to some issues, but I still got an A because I had to tell about the plight of children in my human services certificate that I was trying to acquire along with my social services degree, which I could not continue because now I have a special needs child of my
Brenda.
Own.
And I'm so sorry to hear about your experience. We are running short on time. Did you want to ask Jennifer a question about being with families? Or was there something you wanted to share?
Yeah, so I think the work that you're doing is wonderful, and it's very inspirational, and I'm glad that there are much more services in place for kids as opposed to when we were in foster care. And I hope that people that are, you know, don't question whether or not they can handle a foster child, that they just actually take the step forward and actually just try.
Thanks, Brenna.
Brenna, I hope the same. I think that that's where the key to reform in our foster care system lies, is making sure that every single child has the opportunity to live in a family where they will get the parenting that allows them to really reach their dreams like you are doing.
Jennifer Rodriguez, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Rodriguez, Executive Director of the Youth Law Center, which advocates for youth in foster care in the juvenile justice system. And thanks to our callers for sharing their stories. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.